Simply Focus mit Elva Czerny and Dominik Gilda for Life and Joy and Ease.
Welcome back to the Simply Focus podcast, The Good Life Approach, your podcast for life in joy and ease. This is episode number 34. My name is Elva Czerny.
And I'm Dominik Gilda. Hi there. We're so happy we're sitting in the living room of Eve Lipchick's apartment in Milwaukee, and we're grateful that we can be here and interview you about solution focus. You were a founding member of the BFTC,
yes.
And
mm-hmm.
You were part of the initial team, and we're so happy to talk about this phase, about what fascinated you back then and how you developed this approach together with Steve DeShazer, Insoo Kim Burke, and others.
I'm very happy that you're here. It's been lovely meeting you, and I've enjoyed talking with you so far, and I'm sure I will continue.
That's absolutely likewise. Thank you very much, Eve. So, Eve, what fascinates you with solution focus?
What fascinates me? Well, it's a part of me now, but maybe you should ask me what fascinated me to begin with. That takes me back to 1978. So there wasn't a solution-focused therapy. What fascinated me then was that I was trained as a psychodynamic therapist, and when I went to the Family Therapy Training Institute, where I went to get family therapy training, I was introduced to systemic therapy. And Insoo Berg was my supervisor. And Insoo already had a very forward-looking view, and she was attending workshops of all kinds that were avant-garde. And she was newly married to Steve DeShazer, who was also working at Family Service. He wasn't in the program teaching, but he worked there as a therapist. So I became very interested in not only systemic thinking, but these new ideas that were being introduced. And what Insoo and Steve were doing at the time, that was about the second year I was in the program, probably in 1979. They were inviting special people to their home in the evening, certain evenings of the week. And what they did there is they were experimenting with some new ideas, mostly ideas that came from the Mental Research Institute in Palo Alto. Mm-hmm. Steve had been out there working and hanging around the Mental Research Institute, and he was very taken with the brief therapy model. And Insoo went out there for a training seminar or something, and Jim Dirks, who was one of the founders, knew someone who knew Steve, and Jim asked that person whether he and Insoo could stay at Steve's apartment if there was enough room. And Steve said yes. So the way Jim told it was that they walked in, Steve and Insoo took one look at each other, and they were gone. Mm. And he said he moved out after a day or two. So Steve decided to come back to Milwaukee with her, and they made plans together. Mm. It's going to be a mental health agency and a research center, and we're going to develop ideas along the lines of the Mental Research Institute. But the MRI brief model was for individuals, and they wanted brief family therapy, because that's what BFTC stands for, brief family therapy. So in 1979, they were married, they had bought a house, and they started experimenting with ideas. And so they asked friends of friends if they're willing to become and be clients, and they invited a few of us who were interested, and there were other people from Family Service who were also interested, and we would come and we would stand on the landing of their staircase. The individual or family were interviewed on the main floor, and it was videotaped, you know, and of course it was with permission of the clients, and then afterwards we would discuss what was going on. So that was sort of before there was a BFTC.
So before the mirror, you were standing on a staircase.
Yes. It was fascinating. So I really got interested in that. You know, this was far beyond family therapy. It was more creative.
And what was it that fascinated you about that?
It was such a different way of thinking. First of all, I really liked thinking systemically rather than psychodynamically. And then pattern interruption, the whole thing was a very new thing for me, and the strategic aspects of it and working with a mirror. It was mind expanding for me. I hadn't thought about these things before, and I felt very privileged to be part of that. So from the home visits at their house, they decided decided to start an agency, and Jim Dirks and Steve rented an office and started BFTC. Mm-hmm. The reason that other people could not become founders is because they were breadwinners for their family. It required that you didn't have to make money to join. And I fortunately didn't have to. I had someone who could support me. Marilyn LaCourte did too. Jim's wife was a teacher, and it was okay with her. In Sioux State, as I told you before, she stayed at family service for a whole year after the agency was established in order to support the two of them. So we had this office, and we had a viewing room in the middle of this one large room, and there was a mirror facing either way. What would happen is we had audio hookups to both, of course, but we were so into listening to these cases, and we had such few cases, we wanted to hear everything, that we would sit there and we would exchange earphones so that we could hear both cases at the same time.
So there were two cases going on at the same time, and they were exchanging earphones. And
yeah. If we were lucky, we had two cases going on. It was a slow beginning, believe me.
How did you come to your first clients?
Well, first of all, it was decided that I'm the public relations person in the group, and I had to go out to all the big industries and introduce us and go to the medical departments and say, this is what we do and it's special. And some of them were interested and sent clients, and I asked people I knew personally, you know, to refer to me, and they did. I don't know why. Well, I had previous experience in Rochester, New York, where we had moved from. Yeah, that's how we got our first clients. Yeah.
And back then you thought it will only be a research center without this big influence in the world. And now if you look at it and see what is going on worldwide, what do you think about that?
We would have said it's an unbelievable dream. You know, you meet the right people at the right time, too. A lot of credit goes to Steve. I have to give Steve the credit he deserves. He started a newspaper that he sent out. He was always very well read. He knew the field. He knew who was on the edge. And he started this newspaper that he sent out to people, in which he told them what we were doing. And so people began to know about us and would ask to come and visit after a while. You know, people who were also exploring and experimenting. O'Hanlon was one of those people, you know. And so what we did at BFTC with these cases, we videotaped them. We had plenty of time, and then we would look at them. And we would play around with the videos, not only with what had happened that we were listening to and observing, but we would do things like shut off the sound. And what are we experiencing? We would explore a case from beginning to end for all kinds of ideas. Steve would be standing at the blackboard, and he would take notes. And that's why I say Steve deserves probably the most credit. He conceptualized what we were doing, and he began to formulate some writing about it. And of course, his books made a big difference. I have to admit something to you. I gave a talk a year and a half ago, and I went back to reread the first book, and I was horrified. It is really bad. Patterns was really, it was badly written. Keys is much better. I was just like, oh, not really. This book made a difference, but it did. And so Steve, he put it all together. And yet, what he put together was our discussions, our ideas, the group's ideas fed his imagination as well. So it's very hard to separate it all, except that he put it into words. And then there was a time when our group got this invitation to a weekend in Connecticut where the most famous family therapists were coming. You were going to stay at this big mansion and everybody was going to be there. Maybe there were going to be 30 people there. You would eat together and talk together and people would present, and we couldn't figure out how we got invited. And then we decided, can we really go? These people are the tops. Peggy Pan and the Ackerman and everyone. So we bit the bullet and went, and we were very protective of each other, and we we sort of clung together because there were all these important people. And every night after dinner, people showed their videotapes of their cases. And on the second night, Steve got up and showed one of our tapes. And Lyman Wynn, who I don't know if you know his name, he was head of psychiatry at Rochester, New York, where actually I was living. And he was, in a way, a grandfather of family therapy. Very honored man, very creative, a lot of writing. And he listened to this tape and came over to Steve and said, oh, I want to talk to you. Long story short, Lyman took us under his wing and he came out to Milwaukee. He had a daughter living there. And he came and saw what we were doing, and he was very instrumental in promoting solution-focused therapy, and he was a man who had the connections to do it. What else shall I tell you?
Well, one thing that we're very interested in is how did you learn? Because Gail Miller, that we met yesterday, told us about when he first came and you had this ecosystemic approach and then from that going to solution-focused approach. Yes. How did you learn? How did you development? How did that happen?
What happened was that, you know, we experimented with different theories and developed the ecosystemic approach. And what we would do, we would be a group behind the mirror. We weren't that busy, so there was at least two people behind the mirror. And we would do crazy things. Anything went. If somebody said, well, let's do this, let's try this, it's never been done before, a kind of an intervention, you know, a homework assignment. Yeah, okay, we'll do it. We tried anything. We threw the I Ching to see what kind of intervention we should give. Insu would do her gymnastics behind the mirror. I mean, it was just, it was this crazy place. People were eating and drinking, not alcohol, but, you know, it was... So we had developed sort of a assignment over the last 6 months or 8 months, I don't know. This would have been maybe beginning of 82. So at that point, we all had developed the idea of asking people what they don't want to change. Mm-hmm. We were still problem-oriented, okay? That's what we would ask, and they'd come back and tell us, and then we would work with that. So one day, at the end of a session with a family, one of us, some say it was me, some say it was somebody else, doesn't matter who it was, said, why do we always ask what they want to change? Why don't we ask them what they don't want to change? So we said, oh, that's a good idea. Go with it. So we did. People came back and they were much better. And I said, well, that's interesting. So we said, let's do that again. So we did it with another case and another case and another case. We started getting the same results. And then we started to figure out what the heck was going on here. Something was different. And that's how solution-focused therapy was born. We began to analyze what was going on, realized that when people looked at what was working instead of what wasn't working, and that led into solution-focused therapy. It was interesting because we would have videotapes of all the cases, and usually the first maybe six sessions, there would be problem discussions that finally began to change maybe in the seventh, eighth sessions. The minute we turned to solution-focused thinking, I had tapes where the first eight sessions or seven sessions could just be eliminated. That's how much shortened the therapy became by focusing on the future and exceptions.
Wow. You just mentioned you analyzed and tried to figure out what's different there. How did you do that? So what exactly was it where you were looking at and what questions did you ask yourselves? What was helpful in analyzing the cases?
The same question all the time. What's working and why is it working and why is it not working? Same question. Over and over again.
And then learning from the clients and the responses that you get.
Yeah. It was a open-minded process. We were very open-minded, open to anything.
So you were a team of five people?
Most of the time. Sometimes we had a guest or so from family service. one of those people who couldn't join us because they couldn't afford to. And then later on in 82, 83, 84, as we got a little bit better known, we'd have visitors from all over the place. Yeah. But that, you know, increased to international visit, that went on, 85, 86.
Yeah. I'm very curious, you were a team of five people and I'm sure there was a lot of agreement and also disagreement.
Yeah.
What did you disagree with? Or what was your special perspective that you had or that you have?
In those early years, the variety of our backgrounds was welcomed. I had a psychodynamic background, so sometimes I reached over to that thinking about solutions. Marilyn LaCourte had a communications ed. Steve was had sociology background. Insu had social work. Elam had years of family therapy. He was a professor at the university. He wasn't there full time, but he was there a lot. So in those days, we would all say what we thought was going on and what we thought would be a good way to respond to the clients at the end of the session and what kind of an assignment to give. There weren't disagreements. It worked out. There was a consensus. And I think people would say, oh, yeah, that's better. I like that better. You know, we would work that way. It was very good teamwork.
And for all those people who didn't read the books and maybe are not that deep into the stories, I would really love to hear the story of how the miracle question of how scaling questions came into the solution-focused approach.
The miracle question is, you know, we all adored Milton Erickson's work, and Steve was such an Erickson fan. He was wearing purple all the time. Erickson always wore purple. So Steve was wearing purple. He was very much into hypnosis and Ericksonian work. So the miracle question is a takeoff of Erickson's crystal ball technique. It's not an original idea.
Also, this question was not just there, but emerged over time and got refined. And
yeah, I mean, it was refined to the way Steve refined it, to how to say it. And I don't really know whether exactly how you say it really makes the difference. You know, and frankly, I didn't necessarily always say if a miracle happened, I would say if anything you wanted could happen tomorrow, you know, if you had a magic wand. I was never so compulsive about the wording and breathing of the techniques.
So what was your special style? Because we heard that everybody had his or her style. What was your specialty or special style?
I think my style was I was connecting with the clients easily. Certainly Steve and I were 180 degrees different, you know. So, and Insu had her own style. There was a time early on, I always admired her way of interviewing, and I tried very hard to imitate her, and then I suddenly realized I better be myself. It didn't work. So Insu had her own style, and Elam was a gentleman, you know. He wasn't any older than I was, but he just looked like a professor with a beard, you know, and he was very sedate. So, yeah, I would say I was considered the one who connected. John Weakland once came. He came often to our agency later in the later years, and one day he was behind the mirror when I was interviewing, and I was very nervous. I don't know why at that point, you know, and I thought I knew his style, which was so different than mine. And I thought, okay, well, oh, so what? So when I came back, he said, I just like your style. He said, you know something, you remind me of my mother. So maybe that characterizes.
I just asked about the miracle question. I would just love to come back to the scaling question.
Oh, the scaling question? That wasn't one of the earlier questions at all. It was sort of a natural outgrowth of us quantifying things and doing things in small steps. It was organic. It grew out of the process.
If you look at the solution-focused community right now or at what's going on worldwide, how do you see that, what's going on? And
that's very interesting because I've been reading some of the articles. It looks what's happening is what happens with any theory. Not that solution-focused is supposed to have a theory, but it does. Anti-theory, whatever. So it looks to me that what's happening is what happens with in anything that has a life span as long as solution-focused therapy. Look at Freud's work, look at behaviorism. People develop their own ideas about it. And my impression is whatever is being developed in terms of platforms and art galleries and all the different nomenclature and different ways of thinking about how to approach a session, basically the philosophy is still the same. And nothing is different except the language. What's emphasized is that the difference now is not on goals, but on preferred futures and on not on behavior, but on description of a preferred future. So that's okay. But what I don't see any writings about is that, and the research indicates that the difference is never made by a method of therapy, but by a relationship, is that no emphasis is put at all on the relationship. And it's hard for me to believe that the success rate of therapy with just this forward focus only is very successful with everybody. I'm not saying it isn't successful in many cases, but, you know, there are cases we get, difficult marital cases, trauma. We treat everything. There's nothing solution-focused therapy isn't good for. There's no such thing. So I haven't been around enough mirrors. I haven't had the opportunity to sit behind mirrors of people who are working in these newer ways. I would love to, and I would love to learn from them. For me, it's hard to imagine that how you meet someone in a session and how you connect isn't the really important underpinning for the rest of what happens. You know, I wrote a book about beyond technique, and I get a sense there's a lot of technique being taught.
And what would you like to see in the solution-focused community in the future, or like to see more of, maybe?
I would just like to see it thrive. I mean, I don't mean to be in any way criticizing the new ideas. They work wonderful. I just want the solution-focused therapy to continue to be appreciated and taught all over the world as it is now. And however it's being used, if it works, great. You know, there isn't one way of doing it, you know.
You just mentioned this importance of connecting, and you also mentioned that this was like what you were known for, connecting to people, and also this beyond technique. So what is it that makes it beyond technique for you?
It's working with a philosophy that says people have resources. People have had experiences that they can use toward a solution. The belief in the basic assumptions of solution-focused therapy, and that that doesn't get lost with too much of a focus on questions and maybe I'm wrong, but it feels like there is a goal for brevity. It's just for my reading, which isn't fair because I'd like to see it being done and I don't have the opportunity anymore.
It connects well to what we sometimes see, especially as solution focus is growing and spreading worldwide, is that people that we see usually start with applying techniques. And the more they get into it and the more they get interested in it, then they get closer to the philosophy and all the assumptions. And what we realize now after 15 years of doing solution focus is that's really a lifelong practice.
Yes.
And it's such a paradigm shift still. It was back then and it still is such a paradigm shift. And it sounds so simple. And it is simple. And on the other hand, when we see in our family life, for example, or in our conversations we have, it is this huge shift in perspective still. And I think everybody who sees it as a practice and sees it as a reflected practice, like you said in the beginning, like what you did and how you reflected, how you learned, can't get around also adapting and embracing the philosophy of it.
Yeah, you put your finger on it. People learn the techniques first. Of course, they have to. And then it's a lifelong thing where one begins to live the philosophy, understand the philosophy. In Europe, that's possible. In the United States, it's not happening because it used to happen until about maybe 1985 or so, when our whole health system changed, our insurance type of system, so that people no longer automatically had insurance that paid for things. people used to work at agencies, and they got money every year for training. So they were able to keep learning. That all stopped. Agencies no longer gave people salaries. They began to give people a job, and they could work piecework. You can work for us, and you get paid by the hour. You give us 40%, you keep 60%. People have stopped training extensively, except at universities. Yes. So the huge amount of American therapists who are not at universities take one-day courses, or maybe a two-day course in solution-focused therapy. Well, you never get to the point where you get, you know, totally involved in it, and then you don't get supervision. I got supervision when I learned things. We would supervise people. I would still be hired to supervise people who were at agencies up till 8, 9, 10 years ago. Nobody gets supervised. And then the people who supervise you may not know anything about solution-focused therapy. So the huge majority are eclectic. They learn things. They learn cognitive behavioral. They learn solution-focused. They learn something else. But they learn it in workshops, and they take a couple of workshops, and then next year maybe they'll take another one. They haven't got anyone to supervise. They can't get immersed in it. There are no one-way mirrors.
I think this is one of the things that Elliot Connie, for instance, with his solution-focused university, really tries to bring into the field also in the United States and worldwide. He connects practitioners and offers this constant learning experience to therapists.
Yes.
And a lot of that online. So this also, what I like about this idea is really bringing people together from different countries, from different part of the world. And creating a learning experience and a constant reflection on it. And this is really
trying to teach it a little bit more in depth. And now in Europe, when I used to go to Europe all the time, I mean, it's so different. You learn something and you immerse yourself in it. You don't go to little workshops to learn. You commit to a particular way of working, and then you learn that in depth.
Especially with solution focus, because it's so fascinating. You see what's happening with your clients and with yourself. So that's very easy for us to get into that and stay into that. And we always say that now, after like 15 years, I think we learn the most. It's so fascinating. After 1 year of practicing, when I was in 2003, got to know solution focus. After a year, I thought, now I know it. And then a few years later, I thought, I have no clue what I'm doing. And then
one
I knew it again.
Knows.
And then I kind of didn't know it again. And now I have the feeling that we learn the most at the moment. So for everyone starting, it's such a fascinating journey to go on and to really get into that and that
it's,
for it's, years.
It's a never-ending journey. One is always discovering things. Yes. I do some consulting now with people with difficult cases, and you know, I'm still learning with them sometimes, and it's wonderful. I love it when I can do that.
That's the amazing thing about solution focus. If we talked earlier about emotions and how people often say we don't address emotions in solution focus, and you wrote a whole book about that, so can you share a little bit about your point of view when it comes to emotions and solution focus and how they are connected?
From day one, Steve used to go into a room that he was going to have a session in and remove the Kleenex before the session started. When people saw the Kleenex, they would cry, and that was not positive. Well, I totally disagreed with that, and I feel people come into therapy because of their feelings, and that those feelings have to be respected. You know, like Luc Isabert says, you have to respect people's problem. You have to ask about it because you have to respect it. That's what they came about. I'm more, you know, in his camp. I'm not saying we're right or anybody else is wrong, but emotions for me are so important because I feel that's what people come for, and their language reflects feeling.
And how do you do that without getting too much into kind of the problem?
You don't have to do that. All you have to do is use it as a method of clearance. So you're really feeling discouraged. Are there times when you don't feel as discouraged? No, you don't have to in any way get it mired in emotions. And you're not trying to bring out the emotions. You're just saying to the client, I understand how you feel. And I think that goes a long way. Oh, I have to tell you something. Marilyn Bongean and I, who started ICF, when we started it, we did this little research project. We asked people after the first session to fill out a form, what was helpful before and what was specifically said that made a difference. And then before the next session, they had to fill out whether our homework assignments and our interventions made any difference or what did make a difference. That was the goal. After 65 of those answers, we found out that nothing we said. Nobody ever said anything specific. What was said in general was, I felt understood. There was nothing to indicate that any of our questions or any of our techniques or anything was noticed by the clients, which I suppose is a good thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It was so telling that they said, I felt understood.
Kind of technique in disguise. Or beyond technique.
So Eve, when you look back to the early days where no solution focus was here and where you are now and where solution focus is now, and you want to leave one message for other solution focus practitioners or people who are interested in solution focus because you think this is a very crucial and important message for them, what would that be?
That message would be, don't use this with other things. Don't mix it in as something that you can do with other things. You commit to a particular way of working and you go in depth in that particular way of working. You can't mix it up. When you're very, very experienced, perhaps down the road, there may be times when you will bring something in, suggest meditation to a client or use EMDR with a client, but you can't do that until you know why you're doing that and why it doesn't interfere with your solution-focused thinking. If there's any message I want to give is you must commit to one method and not try to use it as a technique. Too many people have said to me, sometimes I use solution-focused therapy.
Yes.
Thank you
very much for this message. So let's come to the challenge of the week.
Okay. I would like to challenge practitioners of solution-focused therapy to think about what it is they need to overcome to feel that they're more confident and adept at doing solution-focused therapy.
Thank you very much for this challenge, Eve.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
And we are very curious to learn how this challenge works for you out there and also to learn from you what inspired you with this podcast, what was particularly useful for you and your practice, and invite you to comment on our comment field on www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 34.
And if you have not yet done, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or other platforms.
Eve, once again, a big and huge thank you for hosting us, for having us here, and for this wonderful conversation.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was a tremendous pleasure to meet you and to talk with you.
Thank you.
Lots of luck to both of you, and keep up the good work for solution-focused therapy.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.